Good evening. Good evening. My name is Whitney Moyer, and I am a student supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Bruce R. Andrews Fund, and the Central PA Alumni Club, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, Election 2008, The Press and the Profundity of Race. From Negroid to Negro, from color to black, African Americans as a collective have undergone various transformations in the way in which they are portrayed, included, excluded, valued, and discussed within American culture, politics, and specifically the media. For example, one of the most contentious issues discussed during this year's presidential election was the extent to which race would affect how people voted. Some posited that a President Obama might signal the end of black politics, while others warned against viewing his victory as an end to American racism. As Albert Hunt noted in the International Herald Tribune on November 5th, U.S. politics will never be the same. The election of an African-American president doesn't erase the stain of race. It closes old chapters, however, and opens a new one. Today, African-Americans earn less than two-thirds the income of whites, face an unemployment rate of 11%, almost double that of whites, and the infant mortality rate for babies of African-American women is 2.4 times the rate for babies of white women. Under the best-case scenario, these numbers will improve only marginally over the next 4 years. Nonetheless, the election of an African-American to the presidency of the United States is a milestone in American political history and will help to facilitate discussions surrounding these issues for all people of all races. At this time, I would like to ask that the sound be turned off on all cell phones and other electronic devices. In addition, please hold any questions that you may have until the end when there will be a question and answer session. Out of courtesy for those who may be hearing impaired, and because we are taping this event, we ask that you raise your hand and wait for a microphone to reach you before speaking. I would now like to welcome Professor Mark Rule from the Political Science Department to say a few words about the Andrews Fund.
Okay, thank you, Whitney. Can you hear me in the back? Hey, got a terrible cold today, so hopefully you'll be able to understand what I'm saying. It's great to see such a large group of people here today for this very first event of the Andrews Fund has sponsored. The Andrews Fund has been put together and endowed by the donations of former students, colleagues, and friends in the honor of the memory of political science professor Bruce Andrews, who taught at Dickinson from 1960 to 1992 when he retired. And I want to extend a special welcome to Bruce's wife, Marjorie, and to his daughters, Mary Margaret and Carolyn, who are in the audience tonight. Bruce Andrews was one of the most engaging and most respected Dickinson professors of his generation. He won the Lindbach Award for Distinguished Teaching. He held the Robert Blaine Weaver Chair of Political Science. And he was one of the professors that the John and Ann Curley Faculty Chair was established to honor just recently. I had the good fortune to take a course with Bruce Andrews when I was a student. I took a course in public opinion. And I'll never forget his passion for American politics, as well as his breadth of knowledge and his commitment to giving every political view, even mine when I was 19, a fair hearing. When I teach my American government class today, I still draw on that experience, and I try to meet the standard that Bruce set. I later served with Bruce as his colleague in the political science department for 17 years, and I know that he would have loved the topic of tonight's first Andrews lecture. Bruce was deeply interested in electoral behavior, in the role of race in America, and particularly in the political influence of the mass media, all of which are involved in tonight's talk. In fact, he established some of the very first Dickinson courses to analyze these subjects, particularly mass media. I don't believe mass media was ever a topic of discussion at Dickinson, formal discussion in the classroom, until Bruce made it so. Bruce was also, if you know him, and I see a lot of friends of Bruce out there in the audience, a lifelong Democratic Party activist and a very fervent and fierce one. And he would have enjoyed hearing about any aspect of his party's 2008 victory. In fact, I've been saying with Vicky Kuhn, our director of all things in the political science department, and other colleagues who knew Bruce, we just can't believe that Bruce wasn't here this fall to enjoy Barack Obama's victory. And I might also add, if you know Bruce, that he wasn't here to enjoy the World Series success of his beloved and long-suffering Philadelphia Phillies. It just doesn't seem right. But I know somehow that Bruce is with us tonight. Thank you very much for coming.
And also from the Political Science Department is Professor Vanessa Tyson, who is here to introduce tonight's guest lecturer, Pamela Newkirk.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming. I'm especially excited to see so many of my students. I like you guys, I really do. The results of last week's election and the campaign season that preceded it provide us with a unique and unprecedented opportunity to talk about politics of race at a national level. The election of the nation's first black president is a source of great pride for many of us, and for many different reasons, both personal and political. While this country may not be perfect, we are indeed getting better. And so we're incredibly lucky to have Professor Pamela Newkirk here with us today. She's an associate professor of journalism at NYU and the author of Within the Veil, Black Journalists, White Media, a book that won the 2001 National Press Club Award for Media Criticism. She more recently edited A Love No Less, More Than Two Centuries of African-American Love Letters, published by Doubleday in 2003. And the forthcoming Letters from Black America, which will be published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux this February. Prior to joining the faculty at NYU, Professor Newkirk worked at four different news organizations, including New York Newsday, where she was part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning group of journalists. Since then, her articles on the media and African-American art and culture have appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Columbia Journalism Review, The Nation, and Art News. Professor Newkirk is currently a fellow at the Nation Institute. Please join me in handing a warm welcome to Pam at Dickinson College.
Thank you. That is a warm welcome. Thank you all. Good evening. It's indeed an honor and a pleasure to appear at the Clark Forum. I appreciate the warm hospitality I've been enjoying all day on your beautiful campus. And a special thanks to Professor Harry Poldman, with whom I coordinated my outfit today, and Vanessa Tyson, who has quickly become a dear friend. And thank you all who have gathered here tonight to discuss the role of the press in this historic election. And also, you, Whitney, I am so impressed with Dickinson students. I think you're so well represented by Whitney. Whitney for president. Thank you. It is exciting to be here at this propitious time in the life of this nation. Whether or not you supported President-elect Obama, we all have cause to celebrate the realization of our nation's most cherished ideals. About a month ago, while in the throes of a book deadline, grading mounting papers, and the distraction of what seemed to be an endless election, I was asked to provide a title for a talk I had not yet written. And in my frantic quest for an alliterative title, I flirted with many words that can easily replace or could have easily replaced profundity. There was presidential politics, the press, and the perversity of race, presidential politics, the press, and the perplexity of race, and the pervasiveness of race, and the paralysis of race, and so on. I settled on profundity, given the national and even global impact of the 2008 presidential campaign that would change the course of American and perhaps global history. Profundity also captures the intensely pervasive role of race in the media coverage of Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign, an intensity most glaringly characterized by an endless loop of footage of a ranting pastor and national headlines that variously characterize Obama as too black or not black enough. So before I discuss the role of the press in this election, it may help to understand my analytical lens. For more than two decades, as a journalism practitioner, teacher, and critic, I've devoted a considerable amount of time to the issue of media diversity. During more than a decade working as a daily journalist at four news organizations, I rose from covering an upstate New York town hall to coveted assignments in the New York State Legislature, Capitol Hill, New York City, and in South Africa, where I witnessed Nelson Mandela's historic release from prison. But despite my success, I often found myself swimming against powerful currents in the newsroom, where a fixed and warped view of black life made difficult the task of portraying the reality. Even my most well-meaning white colleagues helped perpetuate both the hypervisibility of blacks as criminals, entertainers, and athletes, and the invisibility of members of black, brown, and poor communities when they failed to conform to deeply ingrained stereotypes. For many of my colleagues, the nuanced reality of black life was far less palpable than the fiction that passed for authenticity. I saw how news was filtered through a prism of white interest, even in cities like Washington, D.C. and New York City, where people of color comprised the majority. So the crimes against or successes of black and brown people were deemed less newsworthy than those of whites. And while conducting research for Within the Veil, I interviewed dozens of black journalists across the country who expressed their frustrations trying to report perspectives that fell outside of the white cultural mainstream. I explored how it took someone as prominent as Bryant Gumbel 5 years to convince NBC to take the Today Show to Africa, the only continent other than Antarctica it had not broadcast from. I examined how black journalists from news organizations like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Time Magazine, often felt coverage was skewed to undermine the intelligence or the integrity of black subjects. I detailed the uphill battle of Time reporter Sylvester Monroe as he tried to provide a nuanced profile of Minister Louis Farrakhan. I've argued that frustration over coverage and the inability to make a difference helped explain the low percentage of black journalists and other journalists of colors at mainstream news organizations. Racial attitudes in the newsroom had resulted in the low retention of journalists of color. Indeed, a Freedom Forum study in 2000 found that while the newspaper industry had hired 550 journalists of color each year since 1994, 400 journalists of color had annually left the business. Particularly disturbing were figures showing that 600 journalists of color were brought into the industry in the year 2000, but by year's end, 698 journalists of color had left. A more recent study of the Washington Press Corps found that half of the journalists of color identified in the 2004 survey were no longer part of the Corps by 2008. So despite the explosive growth of racial minorities nationwide and a greater need for journalism that mirrors a more complex and rapidly changing society, news industry diversity has remained an elusive goal. And this is despite the fact that news industry diversity has for nearly four decades been an industry preoccupation, one that has erupted into contentious debates, lawsuits, and mistrust across the racial divide. The resistance to and the undervaluing of diverse perspectives has not only resulted in the disillusionment, anger, and ultimately the exodus of many African-American journalists, it has also resulted in news coverage lacking in complexity and insight. It failed to convey why so many blacks celebrated the acquittal of O.J. Simpson, or why so many do not trust the courts or police officers due to a long history of negative experiences with both institutions. It fails to explain why year after year, roughly half of black students fail to graduate at the end of 4 years of high school, and why this is not viewed as a national crisis. And of course, the media failed to prepare America for the glaring racial and class disparities in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. The legacy and routine discrimination in housing, education, and employment continues to resonate, and income and poverty levels in the respective states of our segregated schools and in the very segregated nature of our society. So even as we celebrate Senator Obama's stunning victory, or should I say President-elect Obama's stunning victory, many of the observations made 40 years ago by President Johnson's National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, which said we are living in two nations, black, white, separate, and unequal, still hold true today. In a stinging indictment of the news industry, the commission condemned the media for its failure, for their failure to convey the complexity of black life. Quote, "The media report and write from the standpoint of a white man's world," it said. "The ills of the ghetto, the difficulties of life there, the Negro's burning sense of grievance are seldom conveyed." The report, known as the Kerner Commission Report, criticized as shockingly backward the media's record of hiring, training, and promoting African Americans, and said the media write about blacks as if they don't marry, die, and attend PTA meetings. Behind the obvious strides by individual people of color during the four decades since the Kerner Commission report, African Americans and other people of color remain sorely underrepresented in the news industry. And many of the stirring stories of black life, of American life, go untold. Today, racial minorities comprise 34% of the national population, but hold just 13% of newspaper jobs, according to the annual survey by the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Some 40% of American newspapers still have no journalists of color at all. Television has been more inclusive. While people of color are still underrepresented, the most recent figures from the Radio and Television News Directors Association show that the minority workforce at non-Hispanic television stations remain largely unchanged at about 20%. In fact, the percentage of minority journalists had remained virtually the same over the past 15 years, fluctuating by 3 percentage points even as the minority population soared. And of course, none of the anchors on the top cable and network news broadcasts are of color. The percentage of minorities in radio has increased from roughly 6% last year to about 11% this year. A survey of the Washington Press Corps conducted this year by Unity Journalists of Color and the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Arizona found that 65, or 13% of the 495 journalists in the Washington Press Corps were of color, up by 2.6% from 2006. 80% of newspapers with Washington staffs had no journalists of color, and some, including the Baltimore Sun and the Dallas Morning News, had all white male staffs. Now, these figures may strike many as irrelevant given the election of the nation's first African-American president. In the afterglow of this historic election, the results may overshadow the reality of the mainstream news coverage, which largely followed predictable patterns. While there are too many instances of media bias to catalog, much of the media viewed Obama through a prism of race and difference. A cover story in the New York Times on February 2, 2007, under the headline, "So Far, Obama Can't Take Black Vote for Granted," quoted blacks who question Obama's blackness and Americanness. One man, a barber, was quoted saying, quote, "When you think of a president, you think of an American. We've been taught that a president should come from right here, born, raised, bred, fed in America," with the suggestion lingering that Obama wasn't American. A political scientist in that same article was quoted saying that blacks, quote, "have a right to be somewhat suspicious of people who come into the country and don't share their experience." The same story cited polls showing Obama garnering 20% of black support compared to 60% for Hillary Clinton. The perception of an Obama who was not black enough would quickly change once he began to secure a high percentage of the black vote during the primaries. Then many of the stories question whether racial loyalty would limit his reach. Was he too black? Other stories in mainstream media question his religion, his slave-owning kin in Kenya, and his patriotism. For weeks, major media ran stories on his refusal to wear a flag pin. Almost weekly, the media released poll after mind-numbing poll, which sliced and diced people along religious, race, and class lines, suggesting that voters would follow traditional lines of allegiance. The stories also suggested that Obama's support among African Americans was somehow racially based, ignoring the earlier support they had given to Clinton or the many white Democratic candidates who secured 90% or more of the black vote. Then who can forget the daily endless loop of Reverend Wright and his sermon, a media revelation that could have offered light, but instead was steeped in heat. In previous times, this concentrated focus on Obama's relationship to Wright could have spelled the end of his campaign. But much had changed in the media landscape between 2004 and 2008, which I will argue gave rise to the counter-narrative. To begin with, the newspaper industry, beset by steep circulation declines, rising costs, and massive layoffs, which extended to the nation's leading companies, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe, had pretty much destabilized the industry. Over the past year alone, the newspaper industry has lost 2,000 jobs, and more are expected given the steep drop in advertising revenue. Just last week, the Christian Science Monitor announced it will cease publication of its daily newspaper and switch to a weekly print and daily online edition. The Audit Bureau of Circulation reported a 4.6% circulation decline for 500 newspapers surveyed for the 6 months ending September 30th, and this is on top of a similar decline last year. Meanwhile, newsstand sales of magazines dropped from $47 million in 2007 to $44 million during the first 6 months of 2008. So in this climate, the call for newsroom diversity has been chilled as the industry fights for its very survival. Also, both fueling and filling the breach of their waning influence has been the internet. A Pew Research Center study on the internet and the 2008 election found that during the course of the election, 46% of Americans used the internet for political news, up from 31% in 2004. In addition, 39% of online Americans use the internet to gain access to primary political documents and to view campaign events. TubeMogul, a measurement firm, said videos produced by the campaigns of McCain and Obama were viewed 2.3 billion times by Election Day, while Tina Fey's impersonation of Sarah Palin on Saturday Night Live was viewed more than 50 million times, as was Katie Couric's interview with Palin, which was seen millions of times on YouTube. An engaged public was also able to watch Senator Biden's speech on race as many times as they'd like. Meanwhile, the total viewership of NBC, ABC, and CBS fell 5% to 23 million last year. So many were able for the first time to this degree, view Senator Obama's record beyond the narrow prism of major media. And in the final days, as we know, the major media focused on allegations that Obama was aligned with terrorists. So viewers could balance these allegations and media coverage with direct responses from the candidate through email, campaign-produced video, widely seen on social networks, on YouTube, and on BarackObama.com. So the rise of the counter-narrative, which was aided by filmmakers like Michael Moore, whose small-budget documentaries captured mainstream audience, also fueled the rise of a more progressive media with personalities like Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow. What's wrong with my tongue? Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. These left-of-center commentators whose views in the past would have been seen on less prominent media now were widely viewed. So now, in the aftermath of the election, some have already begun to question its impact on race. Some have even questioned the need to eliminate affirmative action or other measures intended to address our racial past. Such extreme responses presuppose that President-elect Obama's election will bring an end to racism or racial disparities. What his election will undoubtedly help change is the skewed coverage of the black male, who could no longer be solely seen as an entertainer, athlete, or criminal. Whether it changes the complexion of the newsroom remains unknown. However, if Senator Obama, President Obama, focuses on the issues like education he professed to care deeply about, those issues would necessarily receive more sustained attention from a press that largely mirrors the priorities of those in power. And of course, we will all have the ringside seat and will watch this transition with bated breath. So I'd be happy to take your questions and hear your own perceptions of this election. Thank you.
I'm wondering if you attribute the small number of journalists of color to what I observed as a close watcher of the campaign and also as a participant in the campaign since February. The decreased role of Michelle Obama after the Democratic National Convention, and do you attribute, did you notice that first of all, or am I just imagining it? And then if you did, would you attribute that to the campaign's awareness of viewing the campaign through white male eyes primarily?
Okay, so you're asking if there was a drop
in her exposure.
Her exposure.
Right. At the National Convention when she was the girl from South Side of Chicago, and I've discussed this with friends, but I haven't seen anything in the press about it, that people were feeling threatened by her blackness, whereas his being biracial, less threatened from the Iowa primary on.
Yeah, I mean, there may be something to that, but that's more of a campaign issue than it would be a media issue. I mean, what I would say is that we probably saw more on-air African-American pundits throughout this campaign than we had ever seen before on all of the networks. I mean, they weren't regular staffers, but a lot of people were brought in by CNN, MSNBC, all of the networks to serve as commentators on the election, which spoke to the need for diverse perspectives that did not naturally exist in those newsrooms. I don't know if that answered your question, though.
Curious if you observe that too.
Yeah. I was wondering actually whether you thought age was a bigger factor than race. And you referenced Sarah Palin on SNL, and it was more a factor that she was the vice president candidate for McCain, that his age was a factor more so than Obama, and I know CNN statistics showed that as well.
Well, I mean, I would certainly agree that for Senator Obama, you had the perfect storm, right? You had Sarah Palin, who caused many people to feel a little uneasy. You had Senator McCain, who seemed a little unsteady once we had this financial crisis. You had the youth vote, which had been mobilized largely due to the online presence of Senator Obama, who reached out, you know, through social networks and various ways to keep that base mobilized. And many people thought you guys wouldn't turn up at the polls. You did. So, yeah, I think all of those factors contributed to the success. You had a question?
A number of people have commented that Obama's not being an African-American whose ancestors came from that slave experience,
that that was invaluable to him in negotiating some of the difficulties he had. I wonder if how you comment on that. Is there any substance?
I guess
to
my
think
comment
that
is that it's just so ludicrous that there's an African alive who wasn't affected by slavery. Whether you were in the United States, the Caribbean, or Africa, slavery was a global market. It was not unique to American soil. So I never understood why people would say that because his father was African, that sort of like, you know,
that there
was no history of slavery coursing through his veins. And he had a mother from Kansas. And you cannot be a white American without some dealing with slavery in your ancestry. We're all in this. You can't kind of separate people out that easily. Maybe that perception helped him, but the reality is that he was as implicated and, you know, drawn into the drama of slavery as any of us. And let's not forget, he is American. He was born here and largely raised here and educated here, so I just don't understand that line of thinking. But I think it helped him. I do agree with that. Yeah.
Hi. Sorry. You talked about like papers such as the Christian Science Monitor going strictly to the internet. I was just wondering if you could comment a little on like what black or white journalists are doing now that the average age of the newspaper reader is increasing instead of going down.
Well, I think when I say the industry is in crisis, I mean that in a very real way. Part of the crisis is no one knows where this is headed. No one sees a viable future for newspapers given the demographics of the readership, and not just the readership, because I think people your age read. You just read differently. You read it like disaggregated. You read a story from the Post and a story from Slate and a story. So you're reading every bit as much as my generation. You just read it differently. But most importantly, you don't pay for it. So the business model for newspapers, a colleague said this a few weeks ago, and I do agree that at some point in the foreseeable future, we will all think it absurd that we killed so many trees to provide a daily newspaper. I mean, in the not too distant future, the very idea that you know, we did that to the environment for newspapers will seem totally absurd. Yeah. And I do know that part of the reason your generation doesn't want to read newspapers, you just don't like the ink on your hands. You don't like what it does to the environment. You have a totally different take on newspapers than my generation. We love it. Like I love a newspaper. I love the way it feels. I love the way it folds. I love the whole thing. I love the story placement and what that says about the editorial decisions that were made. And all of that is a part of my generation, but my generation is not determining the future of the industry. It's your generation, and you don't buy it. Yeah. Oh, and I'm sorry, and the last part, what happens to these journalists who are being laid off and bought out right now, they don't know. I know many of those people. They're my friends. And it really is a crisis because online, just about everything is free. So some of those people are at home blogging and they're doing exciting stories, but they're trying to figure out how at some point they will be paid as they had been, you know, before they were laid off. Yeah.
I was wondering if the media's consistent overplaying of Reverend Wright's sound bites during February and March directly impacted McCain's ability to use that in the actual campaign.
Oh, definitely.
After the Hillary primary.
Yeah, but I also think that the mainstream media overplayed its hand and underestimated the hunger of the American public for substance. Okay, we knew about Wright, and people had analyzed it, and either they were going to vote or not vote for Obama based on this alliance, this, you know, relationship. But I think many were looking for far more than that, and that speaks to, you know, the number of people who went online to read policy papers, to read. I mean, people were going way beyond what they ordinarily did to become, you know, to participate in an election. So, hooray for the American public, you know, which really outsmarted the media in many ways. The media could not keep up with the demand for substance, which is a shame because that should be the role of the media. Yeah, but they took the cheap shot and thought that you could just continue to titillate the American public. And how many times could you see that film? Like, after a while, it was just ridiculous. I couldn't believe, and every time they'd say, Reverend Wright, there we go again, right? See it again. I didn't get it, and I think I was right in that people tired of that. It was too easy and cheap, and it didn't really tell us what we needed to know. Yeah.
Excuse me, I think maybe you've answered my question, but in addition to the change from the paper and texture of newspapers and
you
and
like
magazines,
it too, don't
yes,
you?
I like it too. I also am aware of the idea that the American public doesn't want to deal in anything more complicated than a soundbite anymore.
Well, I think now, that's what the media thought, because that has been the trend, right?
Okay.
That the stories have gotten shorter, and the stories have to be sexier, and you have to throw in a name of a celebrity,
right,
even when you're doing a political
story. And especially
story.
On the television and radio, you also have to add all that time for advertising, so everything has to be short.
Exactly.
So how do you think that this hunger is going to be addressed
by the
media?
Right now it's being addressed by the internet. The question is how long that model can last if so much of the content is coming from newspapers, which have paid staffs, foreign bureaus, you know, budgets to send people across the world to get the stories, to gather the news. This is an expensive enterprise. And for that to be co-opted by the internet for free is now, you know, causing the collapse of the structure. So many 2,000 reporters, journalists, left the newspaper industry this year. Last year, the numbers were pretty similar. Going forward, we're going to see that again. So for the short run, yeah, the internet can fill that need because it has all this free content. But when the content is no longer provided, which I try to tell young people, you better figure this out because you're going to have a world of, you know, without information if you don't have people to gather it, people who have, you know, the wherewithal to ask the right questions, to get the right information. Without that, you're just going to have people, you know, blogging in their pajamas who don't know any more than you do. So, you know, that's where we're headed. But right now, it's a crisis because no one knows how this plays out. I mean, it makes no sense. You know, going forward. It only makes sense right now, and it
it sounds a lot like what we were talking about with the financial market. It's like a pyramid scheme. And at the end, someone, is a lot of someones are going to get hurt. Because it doesn't make, it you cannot sustain this model.
Can you also say that folks are having, reporters are having a dissatisfaction with what is being framed as the end story? You know, I've got to have a tagline. I've got to have a bumper sticker, something that's flashy and catchy. And right now, we are not holding reporters responsible for going out and doing the research and providing that in-depth look and analysis to stories that we want to read. And as you say, there's a lot of information that's flowing around, and so you can read different newspapers and headlines and do the analysis yourself. So you really, you know, they've pretty much worked themselves out of a job. Now, as far as with President-elect Obama, you made an interesting point in answering one of the questions in that you're seeing more increase of minority media pundits and reporters.
Well, in the short term, you saw it during the course of the election.
Right, but I think that's going to carry over into his administration because I think right now the majority race reporters are somewhat hampered by the fact that if they do any amount of criticism of his administration or his policies, and you're not always going to agree with everything somebody says, that somebody's going to pull the race card and say, did you make that comment based on the fact that you really disagree with his principles and policies, or are you racist in making that comment? And until we get comfortable with ourselves and with just being able to say that you disagree or agree with his policies, it's going to be a delicate balance.
No, I agree, and I've seen in my own experience where, you know, African-American reporters are dispatched. You know, when there are sensitive areas or when there's a... I got to cover Jesse Jackson's campaign because I was the only African-American in the newsroom. and they probably were sensitive to the coverage and whether when you went hard on him, it would be perceived as, you know, racially motivated or... So maybe you're right. I'm not so sure. Only because diversity has taken such a back seat to the crisis of the industry when you have the top people in the industry losing their jobs. There's no hiring going on. So unless these people are willing to work for nothing, there's just no hiring happening anywhere.
I had a question about diversity. You were talking about new media, the blogosphere, YouTube, the internet in general, and I was wondering if we know anything about racial diversity there. I mean, some of the most important developments in this last campaign took place on YouTube,
right,
or with the Huffington Post, right, you know, and, the, right, and Brock's
well,
comments.
Yeah, so I guess that's what I was sort of getting at, that the internet has somewhat equalized the playing field, and all gatekeepers are sort of created equal on the internet. But there is the problem of the racial divide when you look at who has access to the internet. You know, you still need money. You still have to have the wherewithal. You know, we in these settings just assume that everyone's on the internet. But it's still a pretty elite enterprise, and there are so many people who go to public schools who, I mean, being on the internet is like a big deal. It's a really big deal. So you still have that. You still have a digital divide. I hear that that President-elect Obama has supported many of the media reforms, one of which would include free and open access to the internet, because there are many who question, why are we paying for internet access? Shouldn't it just be, you know, just out there? So that could help level the playing field if we had that. Because right now it's still a pretty top-down kind of enterprise. You know, when you look at who's on the internet, you know, Henry Louis Gates at Harvard started a
a web zine called The Root. But that's Henry Louis Gates at Harvard. You know, I don't see Joe Blow from, you know, down the way just coming up with some fancy site that's getting a lot of hits that's, you know, making the rounds that way. So we still have a way to go before you have that kind of equal access to the internet. But it's a great idea. Yes.
Could I have the microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maureen Dowd's recent column reminds me that we're still in the honeymoon phase, and I wondered if you had any insights in terms of hints from the way the Obama campaign ran their campaign, how the Obama administration will help keep an American population calm and patient in a time when decisions and solutions to economic, housing, and education challenges that we face will not come easy, nor will they come quickly. How will he use the media in converse way to keep us patient and focused?
I don't have any more insight on that than you do. But what I would imagine is that he will have far greater access to the American public, even when he will sort of eclipse the media and communicate directly with the population the way he did during his campaign. Many people got to know him online. Many people got to know him because he would send email and send videos and send policy statements. And so I would imagine he would continue to do that, to use both the major media and to use new media, because his campaign will probably best be remembered by his use of new media.
Excuse me. You talked a little bit about the number of minority pundits that were hired during the election, mm-hmm. and I have to admit that a lot of my friends and I were taking bets on how soon it would be that they would drift away once the election was over.
Yeah, it happened pretty quickly. I think they're
right.
Gone now.
What I was wondering if you had an opinion on whether out of that would come any that would host their own shows, because I thought it's strange that in the last couple of years, the only new minority that got a show out of all this was Dia Hughley, who was an entertainer.
Yeah.
In that, but did you see? In your just your opinion, do you think that?
Yeah,
I wondered.
I wondered about the decision of CNN to give a show to a comedian. You know, in the wake of this kind of election, where people are so hungry for satire, for you know. Media analysis, for political discourse, why you would give that kind of show to someone like him. But, you know, obviously they don't call me when they're making those decisions. Yeah, but there would not be a shortage of journalists of color to turn to for the kind of insight that we got to see during the campaign. You finally got your mic. Yes.
That's all right. I was wondering, as a journalist, in your knowledge of the American people as opposed to other populations, during the campaign, I was absolutely terrified very often that somehow we as a population were not intelligent enough to recognize in an individual.
No,
in this case, intelligence, sensitivity, great learning, as opposed to the other.
Yeah,
and I was terrified.
Think, yeah, so, and I think many of us underestimated the intelligence of the American public, and I think part of it was Senator Obama himself didn't underestimate the American people. He kept talking to the people. He never got flustered by what was coming at him. He stayed calm. He took a bet on the American people by even giving that race speech. I watched 60 Minutes this weekend, and many of his top advisors said, had he asked them, they would have all advised him not to give that speech. Right? Because, I mean, that kind of conversation in the middle of a political campaign usually spells doom. So he took a gamble, and he
he made a bet. He said, you know what, if I talk to these people, if I reason with them, you know, they just may get it. He was right. And many, many people in the media and throughout the country were wrong, you know, because we're all kind of cynical by what we've seen, especially what we've seen over the past 8 years. It does make you wonder, will they get it? Will, you know, so yeah.
Is there a push amongst journalists to give a more fair reporting of Obama's presidency?
Among journalists of color?
Or a journalist in general.
When you say a push, you mean something organized? Or
are journalists aware or trying more in the reporting that they give to give a more accurate reporting instead of trying to find tricks or things such as, is he too black or not black enough?
Well, I wouldn't know that by the coverage I've seen thus far, but where there's life, there's hope. I don't know. I think this campaign may have been an education for many in the media who thought that they needed to dumb down the coverage, dumb down the discourse, that Americans cared more about sensational headlines than about substance, I think. They were proven wrong. So maybe they'll take notice and kind of up the ante on the quality of the coverage. That would be nice. Yes.
Okay, so one of the things that I've been studying in, with one of my classes is issue of stereotyping and how that affects perceptions of African Americans. You know, Barack Obama is kind of the counter stereotype. He's you know, the proud and responsible father. He's, you know, the Harvard educated, you know, intelligent professor.
Every stereotype, he turns it on its
head. Oh yeah, and I'm very, very excited to hear that, you know, it's now sexy to be a nerdy black professor. Right? I think that's wonderful. But here's my question for you. You know, I, when you were talking earlier, you know, talk about kind of the invisibility of kind of
the
nerdy
Obamas.
People, the Barack Obamas,
the Vanessa Tyson,
this, you know, some of the people like that. What was that experience like for you in the newsroom?
Frustrating. And,
yeah, well, I mean, I imagine you can drive you a little homicidal,
well,
but
no, never quite that bad. you know, I've always tried to appeal to reason. You know, I think it prepared me for returning to school to pursue a doctorate, you know, because I always felt I had to, like, come at them with a dissertation to show why this story needed to be done. You know, facts, figures, you know, I did all of this preliminary reporting just to show that it was a story, which is ridiculous, but it's what you have to do, and it's what Bryant Gumbel, in fact, had to do. I think he had like hundreds of pages of facts and figures before NBC decided to take the show to Africa, because they could no longer look him in the eye and say it wasn't worth it. He showed there were more emerging democracies in Africa than in all of Europe. He showed, you know how whole countries were coming back, and I mean, he had a compelling story that, because of race, wasn't perceived that way. It's the same way that I think if I was in the newsroom today, the story that I would try to tell more than any story is the story of urban education. I don't think that story has been sold to the American public in a way that they would see the crisis and how it affects them. I would argue that we have to see the interest convergence of educating that kid over there that doesn't look like my kid. That educating that kid is every bit as important as educating your own. Because you either educate that kid or you send that kid to jail and you pay even more money, and then he comes back and then your kid is on the same street and it's not hermetically sealed off. Your kid is in the world with those other kids. They're our kids. But race allows us to see people as other, allows us to see it as someone else's problem. It's a black problem. It's a Latino problem. It's not an American problem. So that's the way I would always argue with my editors to try to convince them that this is a compelling American story. It's not a black story. You know, your kids are implicated in this. Your kids will be affected by this. So I hope that answers your question.
Okay. We have time for one more question. So.
Oh, that's all?
The last should be first and the first should be last. Oh, is that fellow?
Two more.
You've indicated or given some explanation about what you saw as anti-Obama bias in the mainstream media. But late in the primary campaign, some folks in the Clinton campaign came out with an analysis of counting how many times Obama was mentioned favorably and how many times Senator Clinton was measured favorably and unfavorably. And essentially said that the media was in love with Obama and was, maybe it was just two biases, anti-gender bias and a racial bias.
But that was the story sold by Hillary Clinton. Well, when there was a real analysis of coverage, what it found that Obama got far more negative coverage overall than any other candidate. It didn't just look at Hillary Clinton versus Obama. Studies looked at Obama compared to all of the other candidates.
And the same question.
And I would not say that the media was altogether fair in its portrayal of Hillary Clinton. It's just not what I'm talking about.
The same charge was made by Republicans that John McCain had gone from being the darling of the news media 8 years before, and I think actually McCain said a couple times on the stump that the media was in love with Obama. I mean, have there been the kind of analyses that you're talking about done that would respond to that chart?
No question. It's the kind of studies that I have my students do. I have them study and not just give their impressions of coverage, but to actually do counts, like to look at, say, the New York Times over a six-month period, and to look at every story that was done on McCain, Palin, or whoever, and to analyze, you know, how many times the coverage did A, how many times the coverage did B. So those studies are being done now. They were done during the primary, and one of them, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking out on the person who authored that study that was the most comprehensive analysis of coverage of Clinton and Obama, but it did show that Obama overwhelmingly received far more negative coverage. Yeah. And I mean, even when it's not considered negative, stories that confine him to race, I mean, think about it. Who wants to be confined to anything? You just are who you are. And if every story you read about McCain talked about his whiteness, it then becomes perceived as a problem. Like, is there something wrong with being white? Why are we reading that he's white? We kind of knew he was, but now, you know, now the media's picked up on it. So it turns it into more than it should be. He's black. McCain was white. What is, you know, why so many stories focusing on those elements? Unless you're going to do it across the board, it's really hard to justify after a time. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
First off, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
My question is, I was wondering if you could sort of compare and contrast the media coverage of Jesse Jackson's campaign with Barack Obama's.
Oh, it's far different. First of all, no one really took Jesse Jackson's campaign seriously. It was seen as groundbreaking. I mean, he actually won primaries. He won the New York primary. He won Michigan. I mean, it was big that he did that. But no one in their wildest dreams thought it was going much further. You know, it would be more than a symbolic campaign. I think to the extent it was taken seriously, it's because he did forged these alliances across race and gender. I mean, he did what Senator Obama built on, right? His Rainbow Coalition. that was new. I mean, that was groundbreaking for a black candidate to forge alliances, you know, across such broad, you know, bases. So, but I think with Senator Obama, he had, some of us talked about this earlier, he had this patina of Ivy League, you know, education. He had been vetted by the elite, right? He's someone who white America, the most elite group, the most elite segment of white America, could buy this his message and could see him in the White House. Jesse Jackson never had that, right? So he was more a messenger for change, but no one saw him as actually occupying ever the White House. So he was never scrutinized to the degree that Senator Obama had to be. With Jesse Jackson, it was more the soundbite, the story. I mean, he was a sexy figure to cover, you know? He was smart. You know, he had this grasp of foreign policy, and like he knew things that no one expected him to know. So it was more exciting. It was stimulating, but it was not a it wasn't as serious as this was. And look, I mean, President-elect Obama, right? Yeah. But that's interesting. That would be interesting for people who've covered both to actually do some sort of comparative analysis of the ways in which they were covered.
Yes. To follow up on the prior question, there actually is some information in the program, a citation from the Pew Charitable Trust as a source, showing Obama receiving almost three times as much positive coverage as Senator McCain, and Senator McCain receiving.
But if you're looking at the last few weeks of the election, that would be true, but most of that was because Senator McCain himself began to run a negative campaign. I think in the primary, when all of the candidates were sort of presenting their platforms and it was a more neutral way to view the candidates, Obama was more negatively portrayed. I think it is definitely true that over the past few weeks, I mean, the guy's been hammering McCain. And some of that was brought on by, you know, his own actions, and some of it was brought on by the collapse of Wall Street and the way he handled it. Yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, everyone is going to have a different perception of the way the election was covered. I know I was on a panel a few weeks ago and with, you know, diehard feminist who was still mourning the loss of Clinton from the ticket. And, you know, they were all, you know, just horrified by the coverage of that poor Hillary received. And they cited a long laundry list of, you know, just horribly biased remarks that were made about her. I think you could find that for any of the candidates. You can find instances of bias. I think with women and with people of color, you have deeply held, deeply ingrained stereotypes that are so difficult to dislodge. And for Hillary Clinton, I think it became even more pronounced because strong women are usually demonized in the media. I studied the campaign of the New York City Comptroller, Elizabeth Holzman. And there were actually comments in New York Times stories which comments like the reporter couldn't imagine her wearing a low-cut blouse. Comments on, you know, her helmet-like hair. Comments, you know, the fact that she was never married and didn't have children, but sort of like made into this this horrible thing. So if my study tonight was on gender, which I do address, you know, in my class, I'm sure I could have brought you a book filled with negative stories about Hillary Clinton. I could do that, and it would all be true. She was stereotyped, just as McCain, I'm sure, was stereotyped for his age. You know, there's no question about that. There are those built-in biases. I think with African-American males, we would all agree that they are the most demonized group in the United States of America and have been for centuries in the media. So I think overcoming that probably was more difficult, but that's not to discount the biased coverage of Hillary Clinton.
I'll have the honor of asking the last question this evening. I'm very pleased to do that. Thank you so much, Pamela, for joining us this evening. You've discussed tonight the erosion of the, what I would call the organized media. And even though I think you referred to the fact that historically the traditional media had a certain, shall we say, cultural, racial blends or stance, you also seem to imply that it was, the media played an important role because it was credentialed. These people had expertise. They functioned as an important filter and source of information for the American public. Barack Obama has been able to, largely perhaps because the organized media has eroded, and the growth of the internet has given him ways to bypass that and speak directly.
Even with this infomercial, let's not forget.
Exactly. Now, is there any danger in the sense with an eroded, organized media and a person who has won the campaign to some extent largely through personalized communication through the internet and building, if you will, his own personal information structure? Is there a danger of moving in the direction over the internet of personalized governance?
No question.
And a form of a sort of Caesarian form of government that is sort of foreign to our system of parties, checks and balances, and the role of the fourth estate?
Well, I think it's an argument for the preservation of the mainstream media. Yeah. I think it's an argument for making sure that we have public television, you know, which has been in crisis for a decade now, you know, with Congress threatening every minute to, you know, withhold funding based on this story or the, you know. So, yeah, it's an argument for as many viable media outlets as possible. And I think, you know, a little bit of socialism in this case is needed. We do need public media. We do need more access, more wide access to the media. But the decrease of the gatekeeper function that organizations like the New York Times provide present both challenges and opportunities. The opportunity for those who have been disenfranchised, who have been shut out, who have not been part of that gatekeeper process can now have a greater say online. But at the same time, I do agree with you that we need checks and balances, and that's what the whole purpose of the media is, to keep the check and balance for our politicians. We need to make sure that that doesn't happen, that it's not Barack Obama television, you know, Barack Obama radio, and that becomes the only news. I don't think that will happen, but I do think we need to strengthen the media, find ways to strengthen the media. Yeah.
Please join me in thanking Pamela Newkirk. And also, as a reminder, we have refreshments available that are provided by the Central Pennsylvania Alumni Club. And once again, we'd like to thank the Bruce R. Andrews Fund. Thank you all for coming, and this concludes our presentation.